Siri was a... what? A bird, I think, the first time I saw her. She was wearing some sort of mask with bright feathers. When she removed it to join in the Race Me quadrille, the torchlight caught the deep auburn tints of her hair. She was flushed, cheeks aflame, and even from across the crowded common I could see the startling green of her eyes, contrasting with the summer heat of her face and hair. It was festival night, of course. The torches danced and sparked to the stiff breeze coming in off the harbor, and the sound of the flutists on the breakwall playing for the passing isles was almost drowned out by surf sounds and the crack of pennants snapping in the wind. Siri was almost 16, and her beauty burned more brightly than any of the torches set round the throng-filled square. I pushed through the dancing crowd and went to her. It was 5 years ago for me. It was more than 65 years ago for us. It seems only yesterday. This is not going well. Where to start?
What say we go find little Nookie Kid? Mike Osho was speaking. Short, squat, his pudgy face a clever caricature of a Buddha. Mike was a god to me then. We were all gods. Long-lived, if not immortal. Well-paid, if not quite divine. The hegemony had chosen us to help crew one of its precious quantum leap spin ships, so how could we be less than gods? It was just that Mike, brilliant, mercurial, irreverent Mike, was a little older and a little higher in the shipboard pantheon than young Marin Aspic. Ha! Zero probability of that, I said. We were scrubbing up after a 12-hour shift with the Farcaster construction crew, shuttling the workers around their chosen singularity point some 163,000 kilometers out from Maui Covenant was a lot less glamorous for us than the 4-month leap from hegemony space. During the C-plus portion of the trip, we had been master specialists, 49 starship experts shepherding some 200 nervous passengers. Now the passengers had their hard suits on, and we shipmen had been reduced to serving as glorified truck drivers, as the construction crew wrestled the bulky singularity containment sphere into place. Zero probability, I repeated, unless the groundlings have added a whorehouse to that quarantine island they leased us.
Nope, they haven't, grinned Mike.
He and I had our 3 days of planetary R&R coming up, but we knew from Shipmaster Singh's briefings and the moans of our shipmates that the only ground time we had to look forward to would be spent on a 7-by-4-kilometer island administered by the hegemony. It wasn't even one of the Motal Isles we had heard about, just another volcanic peak near the equator. Once there, we could count on real gravity underfoot, unfiltered air to breathe, and the chance to taste unsynthesized food. But we could also count on the fact that the only intercourse we would have with the Maui Covenant colonists would be through buying local artifacts at the duty-free store. Even those were sold by hegemony trade specialists. Many of our shipmates had chosen to spend their R&R on the Los Angeles. So how do we find little Nookie, Mike? The colonies are off-limits until the Farcaster's working. That's about 60 years away, local time. Or are you talking about Meg in Spin Comp?
Stick with me, kid, said Mike. Where there's a will, there's a way.
I stuck with Mike. There were only 5 of us in the dropship. It was always a thrill to me to fall out of high orbit into the atmosphere of a real world, especially a world that looked as much like old Earth as Maui Covenant did. I stared at the blue and white limb of the planet until the seas were down and we were in atmosphere, approaching the Twilight Terminator in a gentle glide at 3 times the speed of our own sound. We were gods then. But even gods must descend from their high thrones upon occasion.
Siri's body never ceased to amaze me. That time on the archipelago. 3 weeks in that huge, swaying treehouse under the billowing tree sails, with the dolphin herders keeping pace like outriders, tropical sunsets filling the evening with wonder, the canopy of stars at night,
and our own wake marked by a thousand phosphorescent swirls that mirrored the constellations above. And still, it is Ceres' body I remember. For some reason, shyness, the years of separation, she wore two strips of swimsuit for the first few days of our archipelago stay, and the soft white of her breasts and lower belly had not darkened to match the rest of her tan before I had to leave again. I remember her that first time. Triangles in the moonlight as we lay in the soft grass above First Sight Harbor, her silk pants catching on a weave of willow grass. There was a child's modesty then, the slight hesitation of something given prematurely, but also pride, the same pride that later allowed her to face down the angry mob of separatists on the steps of the Hegemony Consulate in South Turn and send them to their homes in shame. I remember my fifth planetfall, our fourth reunion. It was one of the few times I ever saw her cry. She was almost regal in her fame and wisdom by then. She had been elected four times to the All-Thing, and the Hegemony Council turned to her for advice and guidance. She wore her independence like a royal cloak, and her fierce pride had never burned more brightly. But when we were alone, in the stone villa south of Feveron, it was she who turned away. I was nervous, frightened by this powerful stranger, but it was Ciri. Ciri of the straight back and proud eyes, who turned her face to the wall, and said through tears, "Go away. Go away, Meryn. I don't want you to see me. I'm a crone, all slack and sagging. Go away." I confess that I was rough with her then. I pinned her wrists with my left hand, using a strength which surprised even me, and tore her silken robe down the front in one move. I kissed her shoulders, her neck, the faded shadows of stretch marks on her taut belly, and the scar on her upper leg from the skimmer crash some 40 of her years earlier. I kissed her graying hair, and the lines etched in her once smooth cheeks. I kissed her tears.